You got Bitcoin doing spectacular things and Nvidia doing spectacular things. So gold going to its all-time nominal high, but not its inflation-adjusted high, pales into insignificance next to the other bubble stories out there. But those bubble stories will eventually burst. And gold is probably going to go a lot higher because of all the monetary stupidity that's going on out there.
Hello and welcome back to Soar Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the Edgier Mining Guy on Twitter and your host for this fantastic conversation today. And it's going to be a doozy. I have to admit, I'm really looking forward to this. John Rubino has been on in the past, and that's why I can tell you it'll be good. It'll be great. And I'm really looking forward to this discussion because we have a breadth of topics to discuss. So much going on, as you still know. And remember, it is Fed week and a lot has happened. Bank of Japan announced a first rate increase in 17 years. The Fed is still holding rates steady at a 23-year high. So the opposite of what Japan is doing. Gold exploded higher over 2220. That's what the all-time high mark is right now. It's come down a bit. I think we're trading around 2180 right now. So still up there, but not at all-time high levels anymore, just a few bucks off. So we're going to discuss, of course, what triggered the move and why didn't gold go down when bond yields go up and rates are being lowered as well. So I'm really curious how we can break this down and sort of understand that move. Before I switch over to my guest, quick reminder, A, click on subscribe somewhere down here as well. Leave a like, leave a comment. We do want to hear from you. Are we asking the right questions? If not, what questions should we ask? Put that down below. We do want to hear from you. It's an educational format for you, the audience, and how are we going to get better if we don't ask the questions that you want the answers to, right? So that said, let me bring my guest on. And John Rubino, thank you so much for joining us. Really looking forward to this conversation.
Hey, Kai, great to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, John, I forgot to mention you, of course, a successful Substack author, blogger. What do you call yourself as a Substacker? Are you a Substacker? Are you a blogger? Are you an author?
all of those things. And some people call it a newsletter publishing, too. So it's just, you know, you're on Substack.
Yeah. Substack. Stacking. Yeah, you know, that kind of fits, you know, stacker.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely a stacker for sure.
There you go. Yeah. That's why, like, yeah, it may be fantastic. No, it makes a lot of sense, especially if we talk about precious metals, gold, silver as well. So we should all be stackers here. So, John, let's start breaking it down a little bit. You know, lots has happened this week. But before we start talking about the Fed decision and everything else, like, let's discuss what the Fed is basing its decision on to keep the rates at its level. How healthy is the economy, in your opinion? How are the markets doing?
Well, the economy is extremely unhealthy in the sense that debt has just gone parabolic. You know, so we're buying relative stability right now at the cost of trillions of dollars of new debt year after year after year. And that's totally unsustainable because at today's interest rates, rising debt means rising interest costs. And pretty much every entity on earth right now is seeing higher interest costs. And in some cases, it's getting to the point of being debilitating. So we're not healthy in the longer term sense. But right now, the government is running such huge deficits here in the U.S. that that's supporting consumer spending and industrial production and all the rest, and giving us reasonably good headline numbers. But again, that's unsustainable. But for now, the big numbers make it look like the economy is basically okay. And a lot of people are thinking that we've got a nice soft landing coming and everything. But that doesn't seem possible given the numbers, because if everybody's interest expense is soaring, then consumer spending cannot continue to increase organically unless wages go way up. And they're not, you know, wages are up a little, but not dramatically, not nearly enough to keep up with rising interest costs and other kinds of costs. Because, you know, inflation of the past 3 or 4 years has raised a lot of families' cost of living by like a third. So, you know, you got to go a long way with wages to offset that, and it's not happening. So I think that reality will reassert itself pretty soon in one aspect or another, and then we won't feel like we're in nearly as healthy an economy as a lot of the talking heads out there think we are in.
No, absolutely. I was just Googling here the wage growth and how it is potentially outpacing inflation as well. So I'm curious, like, because the economy is seemingly healthy based on the numbers we've been provided, based on what the Fed is saying. Jerome Powell does not seem concerned about the economy at all right now. Yes, he is dovish. He does want to cut rates, but the economy is giving him no reason for it, meaning like it is a healthy economy, Goldilocks almost, right? It's not too hot, not too cold. There's no reason to cut right now interest rates. So the question is, like, is that wage growth that we're seeing right now? It's about 5.6%, 5.7%, according to official numbers in the US, which is 2%, 2.5% higher than inflation, sort of that soft cushion that the economy needed?
You know, I don't think wages are keeping up with inflation even now, if you look at inflation in real terms, in other words, in what's really happening, not the headline numbers out there. But here's the box the Fed is in any event, because they do have a lot of inflation measures still running kind of hot, like the service sector inflation by some measures is rising at 8% a year, you know, and to be cutting interest rates in the face of record stock prices, as you said, somewhat rising wages, low unemployment, and what was the last one? Soaring interest costs. You know, to be cutting interest rates in the face of what is basically a, in some ways, overheating economy is really surprising. But the fact that higher interest rates are debilitating for a lot of different sectors of the economy, that's not lost on the Fed. They know that they're risking a crisis, for instance, in commercial real estate that spreads to local and regional banks, that spread to pension funds and insurance companies. That's the kind of contagion that we're risking now with higher interest rates. So they do want to lower interest rates. And it's an election year. So they're getting a lot of pressure from the incumbent government to have us go into the election with a nice, strong economy with falling interest rates and all the other numbers being good enough to point to and brag about. So the Fed is being pulled in a lot of different directions. And I would make the case that there's no real right answer, and there's no way to basically fix things from here, because we've taken on way too much debt, and you can't get rid of excessive debt without some kind of a crisis. You don't just, all of a sudden switch over to a nice, steady, organically growing economy after you've taken on massive amounts of debt that are beyond the scope of most of the indebted right now. So they're in a spot where there is no fix, and they're launching trial balloons to see how the markets respond, and they're trying, you know, modest tweaks from here. But I think what's really going to force them to cut interest rates at some point is a crisis of some sort. And the one that looks most likely is, like I said, commercial real estate starts to tank. That affects the banks, forces the government to bail out the banks. And then all of a sudden we're in maybe a currency crisis where everybody's looking at the US and going, all right, we're running $2 trillion deficits. We're going to have to bail out a $3 trillion banking sector. Interest rates are spiking, which means deficits are only going to get bigger from here. Do we really want to hold this currency? You know, and if it shifts the pressure over to the dollar, then we're kind of in the end game. You know, when the currency starts falling in a disorderly way, then you lose your monetary tools. So you can't bail people out anymore. And then it's basically over. So that's coming. And the timing of it is completely unpredictable. But there are things happening now that could constitute the first domino that starts knocking over other dominoes. And that could happen this year. So I think things will get a lot more exciting one way or another in the near future.
Absolutely. John, what is that first domino? Is that the commercial real estate market? Is that?
Well, I mean, it could be a lot of things, but office buildings feel like the thing that is most in danger right now, because over the last decade or so, a lot of office buildings went up using very cheap financing. And they, you know, just by definition, they need pretty high occupancy rates in order to generate enough cash flow to cover the costs of the building. And then during the pandemic, a lot of people found out they don't like working in the offices. They want to work at home. So in a lot of cities, occupancy rates are too low in the office space sector. And as these buildings, as the debt on these buildings come due and have to be refinanced or paid off or whatever, a lot of buildings aren't generating enough cash flow to make that possible. And the buildings are being sold at big losses. And a lot of that, a lot of those potential losses are on the books of local and regional banks. So as those losses are taken by the owners of the buildings who sell their buildings at a loss, the banks have to report their share of those losses. And that then scares the depositors of those banks into pulling out their money, which forces the banks to sell even more assets at a loss in order to pay off the depositors, and so on until the banks start to fail. Then the government has to step in and bail them out, and you've got another several trillion dollars of obligations on an already wildly over-indebted government, and people worrying about the currency. So I think that's how it could play out. Now, whenever you pick the catalyst for the next crisis, it ends up being something else, right? And there are a lot of things that it could be. So, and geopolitics is one of the big ones. We could be at war at any time. Any day we wake up from now on, we could be in a shooting war with Russia or China or Iran or somebody like that, you know, and that would spook the markets too. So that's always out there waiting to happen.
Absolutely. Here, I just want to quickly share my screen here. Let's see if that works. It does, because it is a great graphic put together by our friends over at the Visual Capitalist, and it's the real estate exposure of the largest U.S. banks. And I'm not sure if you can see that, John, but it's a graphic I come across, and I hope it really shows well on the screen for our audience here as well. But as you said, it's the small and regional banks that are carrying most of the commercial real estate burdens percentage-wise of their overall loan portfolio. While it is for JP Morgan only 12.6%, it's $171 billion. You know, for Bank of America, 6.9% is $76 billion. But for the small banks, like the regional banks, and there's New York Community Bank, it's 57% of the overall loan portfolio is commercial real estate. Yes, they've taken over some of the Silicon Valley Bank assets there in the past. So they have massive exposure to commercial real estate, as you can see here. Zions Bank, 30%, M&T Bank, 40%, Huntington also 33%. Extreme high exposure, right? Exactly sort of mirroring what you've said there. And that could be that first domino, I believe, in tumbling the markets. So interesting graphic, but I do want to talk about rate hikes a bit more, because it's seemingly everything's going well. And I want to have a bit of a counter argument there with you, John, as well, because I keep picking up news like this week on Reuters. I saw that Intel is going to invest $100 billion in the U.S., building in four states. It's highly subsidized, a lot of grand money being given out as well. But that sort of stimulus and that investment is keeping the economy afloat, in my opinion, right? So why is there no chance of a rate hike? And B, maybe, and I've asked that other guests as well, is the U.S. getting away with one here? Does that make
sense? Well, it's getting away with a rate hike in the sense of long-term rates being higher. You know, 10-year Treasury, 30-year Treasury yields are up from where they were 6 months ago. So that is tightening. You know, that's a higher interest rate that you have to deal with if you were...
Let me quickly clarify. Sorry, I wasn't clear enough with the B part of the question here. Like, is the U.S. getting away with one? And that means no landing at all. Like, is that a trampoline economy? All right. Do we see that immediate bounce back? Are we currently in the weakness phase and it's bouncing back right away? All right. So that's that part.
Yeah, I mean, we are seeing. See, we're onshoring a lot of manufacturing capacity that used to be in China or wherever. And that is definitely stimulative. And that's really a good thing in the long term for us. You know, the U.S. has a lot going for it demographically and geographically, and now in terms of manufacturing coming back. So, you know, we're probably one of the survivors of the next crisis, just because we're energy exporters, we're food exporters. We've got big oceans on either side, so there's no real danger of a military conflict within the U.S. or anything. So those are all advantages. Now, on the disadvantage side is the fact that our national debt has gone parabolic. And there's a limit to how much debt you can take on and how much interest you can pay without it basically swamping everything else. And I think that would be the big worry for the U.S. is that, yes, there are factories being built here. Good thing. You know, we're producing a lot of energy. We're producing a lot of food. Those are all good things. But at the same time, we're paying for it with a massive increase in debt and therefore interest expense. So I think the debt is growing faster than those other good things are helping, and that's our big risk. But yeah, you know, you've got a lot of cross currents out there, and there's no doubt about that. But I think there's, you know, like you said with that chart with the banks, the small banks are in grave danger. Consumers, even though wages are going up, consumer debt is rising dramatically. Like credit card debt is spiking, and the interest on credit cards and mortgages are also spiking in the same way that the U.S. government debt is spiking. So these are really dangerous trends. And I think that in a rational world, the Fed would be looking at raising interest rates, like you said, because when you've got the stock market spiking like this, and you've got debt spiking the way it is, monetary policy should lean against that, right? Instead of adding more fuel to the fire by lowering interest rates. But I don't think they feel like they can do that right now. So I think they feel obligated to cut interest rates.
They're always saying they're so data dependent, right? So the data tells them we've had 2 months of inflation, higher inflation, 3.2% at the last reading. And as you said, like core inflation or service inflation as well is even higher, right? The question is now, do you see that trend continuing, John? It's like, is inflation going to be higher? Is it just going to be a bump in the road? Is that just two anomalies and March is going to be normal? Or do you see, you know, consistent sticky inflation?
Well, services have been pretty sticky. And part of that is driven by inflation. For instance, you know, within the service sector, there's insurance, car insurance, home insurance, and healthcare, health insurance. And during a period of inflation, when the things you're insuring are getting more and more expensive, then your insurance costs go way up. So that's a sticky form of inflation. And then you got wages rising, you know, modestly, but in maybe in real terms. And that causes, that's a form of inflation. So you've got parts of the economy that are inflationary right now. And that's part of the data the Fed is looking at. And then on the other hand, you've got the big risks out there from people becoming more and more over indebted, and that's a deflationary thing. You know, bad debt is very deflationary. And so we've got these cross currents, we've got these different data points out there that point in different directions. And the Fed, which is normally working with bad models to begin with, you know, the whole Keynesian analysis framework just doesn't take debt into account. And from a Keynesian economist standpoint, if you've got aggregate demand, which is what we're buying in a given year, going up at 3% year after year, it's a healthy economy. Doesn't matter if you have to borrow $2 trillion every year to get that aggregate demand at that point, you know. And I think that's the problem, in a sense, for the Fed, because they have models that that don't really reflect the real world or all of the real world. And so when they look at the world, they don't really understand what they're seeing. And because of that, they're kind of, they're slaves to a lot of these cross currents. You know, you got the political side where there's an election year. And you've got the geopolitical side where the world is incredibly scary right now. And the Fed doesn't want to be tightening going into World War III. You know, you want there to be plenty of liquidity if we're going to start invading people and everything, which we kind of might be pretty soon. So, you know, they're looking at all this stuff, and I think they're trying to do as little as possible right now because they honestly don't understand what's going on. And it'll be a question of which of the big things that are happening out there, the spike in debt, the geopolitical craziness, the increasing inflation in certain sectors of the economy, you know, which of those end up being the most important? And I think that's unknowable right now because they're all pretty important. But I think any one of them can cause a lot of turmoil going forward. And I think in the end, the Fed ends up countering turmoil with easier money because that's basically their only tool, you know? That's all they've got when the world becomes very uncertain and very hard to manage. So one way or another, I see us easing in the next year. You know, I think monetary policy gets easier. either because of a crisis or because of politics or because of geopolitics or just because of the uncertainty that they're confronted with at the Fed and their history of responding to uncertainty with easier money. So, you know, look for the cuts that they're promising now will probably happen one way or another, but it might not be in the way that they hope that it would happen. In other words, in a nice placid meeting where everything seems okay, they decide to take a quarter point off the Fed funds rate or something like that. It might be in a meeting where the world's going to hell and nobody knows what to do. And they think, well, we might as well cut interest rates in the face of this. I think that's
we promised it might as well do it.
Yeah, yeah. Or right. You know, better that there's easy money than tight money, given all the crazy stuff that's happening out there.
Got to ask you though, is money actually really tight right now? Like, it doesn't seem like it. S&P's at an all-time high, Bitcoin is rallying, gold at all-time highs, other asset classes are fairly high levels. It seems like money is still readily available. Yeah, it costs a bit more, but it's available, right? So how tight is money supply?
Well, fiscal policy is incredibly easy. I mean, we're running $1.5 trillion dollars a year deficits, which are, you know, that's an emergency level borrowing for a government, right? And there's no giant emergency out there. They're just, you know, in peacetime running record high deficits.
In a booming economy.
Yeah, in an economy with unemployment at 3.4% or whatever it is now. So that's incredibly stimulus, arguably at the wrong time for stimulus, but it is stimulus. It provides a lot of capital for a lot of people out there to borrow and then spend that capital. But at the same time, you've got, again, rising interest costs out there, which is very tightening for a lot of industries where, you know, let's say you borrowed a lot of money, you did a factory, you did an office building or whatever, and your interest rate was 2% when you borrowed to begin with. Well, now it's rolling over and you're going to have to pay 4 or 5 or 6%. Well, that is a tightening of monetary policy or monetary conditions for you as an individual entrepreneur or an individual company. So we're seeing that kind of tightening where debt is rolling over and the cost of that debt is going way up. And then the interest costs of the entity are spiking going forward. So that's happening out there too. So you got tightening in some sectors and fairly extreme ease in other sectors. And again, cross currents, you know, there's a lot of things happening out there that point in different directions. And because of that, you're hearing a lot of conflicting predictions out there, right? There are people saying, you know, stocks are at the beginning of a new bull market. It's 1998 again, and we got two more years of this bubble market. Or, you know, we've got the hardest landing you can imagine coming in the next year. You're seeing things like that from very smart people, you know? And I think the reason that there are so many differing opinions is that there are so many different factors at work right now. And we only will know in retrospect which turns out to be the dominant factor.
Oh, absolutely. As you said, there's so much going on. 1998 really brings me to what is actually happening today in the stock market. Reddit IPO, right? Massively, it seems oversubscribed. And the stock was up, last time I checked, 64% after the IPO. I think it was the IPO was at $34. It was trading at $60 at some point, $54 at some point. It was up 64-65%. Reminds me a bit of that mania you described back in the days. Like, okay, everything's fine, everything's great, Goldilocks economy, AI boom, let's go. And then 2 years later, 3 years later, rude awakening. Right? Is that exactly what we're in right now? Are we in that? Is it just the beginning of that melt up phase there, John? Or are we in the middle of it or at the end? Because sometimes those IPOs mark the top as well. When everybody, like, I remember conversations where there's always conversation. Oh, you remember that IPO? Oh, that marked the top, right? So curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, you don't know which thing marked the top until after the fact, right? But it could well be that the Reddit IPO.
I was going to say, but forecasting is so much fun, John.
Yeah. but Reddit could be that because, you know, when you look at Reddit, it doesn't look like an incredibly valuable entity, right? It's bulletin boards. It's a lot of people just posting stuff. They have some ads, I guess. I guess that's where their revenue comes from. But now all of a sudden, all the data that is created by all those people posting on Reddit boards out there is incredibly valuable to all the people creating AIs, because that's the data stream that they can use to teach their AIs to become our robot overlords. You know, that's if we're going to have a sentient AI, it might be fed on Reddit data, you know? And so Reddit is suddenly very valuable because they've got content. And, you know, first of all, it's got everybody else looking around and thinking, well, how valuable is my content? You know, can I get a Reddit level valuation out of this, you know, out of this stuff that we've just been storing and not doing anything with? So I don't know is the answer. If you look at a lot of different indicators, you get peak of a bubble readings. For instance, market breadth in the stock market. In 1999, during the tech stock bubble, just a handful of stocks were elevating all the rest of the stock indexes, which in turn was keeping the U.S. economy afloat, which in turn was keeping the global economy afloat. So you had the global economy resting on 10 stocks of companies, only half of which had actual earnings, right? So we're back there again. Those kinds of readings are as extreme as they were in 1999. We've got just a handful of hyper high market value tech stocks elevating the entire US stock market complex. And that's a big factor in global economic growth. So if you just look at that chart, you would say, oh, major crash coming, right? But that isn't how bubbles work. They don't always follow the exact same pattern. They follow a similar pattern where there's a peak, then it crashes, but you can't recognize, or you can't know something as the peak based on past history. You can only know that it was the peak in retrospect. But I will say there are tons of indicators out there right now that are just flashing crash signals, and they tend to scare me.
I'm just sharing the S&P 500 chart. If I look at this, like, I'm sorry, like, what is it? I'm 40 years old, and this chart of a main index is just mind blowing. And that's the last 2 years. Like, why does this not scream melt up, crashes near scenario? Like, I don't, like, we're always doom and gloom in this channel for some reason. We're always looking for the straw that breaks the camel's back. I always seem to find the 15% of the bears in the market. And we always talk about the crash looming. But if I look at this chart, like, how can this not, like, go the other way? Like, how is this even feasible, right? This chart. So, I want to be positive, right? I want to draw scenarios like this is going to go to 6,000, 7,000, let it go, and we're all going to be great. But exactly what we just discussed, I don't see it. Like, there are too many cracks, too many influences and crosswinds and cross, like, streams that are just making this impossible for me to believe, right? So
I'll tell you a quick story that applies to this. Back in like 1998, I was a tech stock columnist for thestreet.com, which was a very hot .com oriented website. And I was the resident bear at the time, because by 1998, everything looked like it was ready to crash. I mean, everything was overvalued. It had to crash. And I used to get massive hate mail because of that. The haters were right, at least for a while, because the dot-com bubble did not burst until early 2000. So it was already wildly overvalued in 1998. It got even more so in 1999, and then it doubled again in early 2000 before it finally burst. This is that kind of a market. Which means it, you know, it could burst right now, and we could see a lot of big companies joining the 90% club, you know, which is 90% down, you know. No. Or all the capital or all the cash that's being thrown into the market by a government running crisis level deficits could continue to elevate equity valuations for a while, because, you know, where's that money going to go? We're basically paying interest on government bonds, and that money is flowing into the pockets of already rich people. What are they going to do? You know, they already own several mansions and big boats and things like that. So maybe they just toss some of it into the stocks that are already working, and that elevates those stocks even further. That's a thing that's happening to some extent, and it could continue to happen. So, you know, you just can't know. But we're at the point where anything that happens that is positive for the stock market going forward has got to be factored into the eventual crash. In other words, the crash will be deeper to the extent that the boom goes on from here at all. So I think at some point there's a big short scenario for us out there where we call that top, you know, and we short the big tech stocks and we short the banks and we short the housing companies and we make life-changing money. Of course, if we don't time it right, we lose life-changing money, you know, but I think it's out there and it's impossible to resist. You know, I'm really looking for it. And maybe it's today. That's the problem. It could be today, but it could not be today too. So,
well, it's like the more I look at this, the more I'm starting to believe that David Hunter or Henrik Zeberg, that like David Hunter is clearly calling for 6,000 to 7,000 in the S&P 500. And I'm just looking at the momentum and I was like, okay, 6,000 is easily possible. And now I'm starting to wonder why am I not participating in this rally? Right? Like just chasing momentum here. And it clearly has momentum. Right. So one more topic before we talk about gold, John. I quickly want to talk about that, I don't know, might be our savior. I don't know, call it Industrial Revolution 3.0, but it's the increase in productivity through AI. Like it's sort of touching on what we're seeing here. Is that going to be enough? Like, and to save the economy in that regard, that increase in productivity per hour, per laborer that AI can bring, is that something that would save us?
Well, that's a thing. But usually the way technological revolutions work is that a lot of pain comes with the gain early on. And in the AI case, to the extent that people get more productive, the companies employing those people need fewer of them, right? So you get mass layoffs. And that's going to be part of the story of AI. And it's not clear what will be the biggest part of the story, whether it'll be the productivity or all the, you know, the paralegals and the mid-level healthcare people and all the administrators out there who are going to get laid off. And we can't know that because those are two very big contending forces. And if one of them turns out to be much bigger than the other, then you get really outside effects from it. And again, I wouldn't even pretend to guess which is going to be the bigger of the two, but there are a lot of Silicon Valley layoffs happening right now. And that could be kind of a forerunner of what's to come when AI really gets going. Because remember, AI is a baby right now in its current form. You know, it's everybody's developing AI models. And then they're looking around for what to do with those models. And in a lot of cases, they don't know yet. And in some other cases, they do. But I mean, what's going to happen to Hollywood when you can make an absolutely lifelike image of beautiful people, you know, and just put them in the background of movies and stuff? You don't have to pay background actors anymore for that. Or runway models still have a job because we want to see the whole person. But magazine models where we're just looking at their faces or whatever, or just a static image, you can recreate those people or those images on AI so that you don't need an entire subsection of the modeling industry anymore. So spread that across the economy. You know, there might come a time when there's just, you know, just podcasters like you and me out there because we're so creative and we still have jobs, but nobody else does, you know? So
who says I'm real? No, John, but that will keep people in their rural communities as well. That will stop, you know, the migration from small communities into larger cities. So that at least in terms of LA, maybe. I don't know. I'm just
that is a very big idea, too, because the demographics of AI are very interesting, because if a lot of the, you know, the information jobs that are now done where you have to live in a city to do it. First of all, combine AI with Starlink and you can live anywhere and do a high powered computer programming job or, you know, graphics job or something like that. You can live anywhere and do it. So that is going to lead to other things being equal, an even greater migration of people out of cities. And a lot of the work that is still going to be done guaranteed is going to be physical work going forward. You know, a lot of growing food and stuff like that. It's been automated up to a point, but it can't be automated much more. And there's still going to be people out there. You know, I did a post on Substack called The Handymen will inherit the earth. So that because the jobs that are going to be absolutely guaranteed to be needed are the physical ones, where if your pipe is leaking, somebody better fix that for you. And no AI is going to be able to do it, at least not for quite
not
a while.
Not yet.
When they have AI plumbers, that's a whole new stage of the process.
Just wait till that Domino's robot rings your doorbell. No, Josh, like one last point on that, like I wrote down, I'm actually quite happy about that question I'm going to ask you, is like, can we mistake layoffs due to AI for proper unemployment? Is that, do you know what I mean? It's like AI layoffs, like, and how do we account for AI layoffs? Does that make sense? Like the question I'm trying to ask, like, because it feels like it's a different type of layoff. It's not just the jobs are not available or like the economy is terrible. It's actually increase in productivity, and we don't need as many workers anymore. So how relevant is that unemployment metric at that point? And what do we do to counterbalance that? Because if we don't need those jobs anymore, where are we going to put those, let's call them workers, the employees? Like, where are we going to put them, right?
Yeah, well, if you look at past technological revolutions, there were more jobs created than were lost. And, you know, a lot of factory workers or say people who worked looms to make textiles. Once steam powered versions of those machines were introduced, then all those people who used to do it by hand got laid off. But there were lots of other jobs for them. So the question is this another of those episodes where AI creates as many jobs as it kills, or is it going to create way fewer than it gets rid of? And then what happens to those people? So that, we'll find out whether the unemployment that's created by AI is long-term structural unemployment or just churn over the next decade. And if it's long-term and structural, then we got a serious problem, because the guys with the AIs are making a lot of money. And the people who used to have jobs are not making any money, and we're going to have to do something about that. And then do we go to a universal basic income or something, which libertarians like me really hate the idea of tens or hundreds of millions of people just getting a check every month for not doing it. You know, that's a scary thought, because it changes society in really fundamental ways. But that might be the thing that we have to do to avoid mass civil unrest. And again, you know, we'll see. There's no way to know exactly how this plays out, but we are definitely in one of those revolutionary periods, and the outcome is going to determine the shape of society. And we're just going to have to see, you know, we're just going to have to see how it plays out.
John, fantastic. We saved the best for last. Let's talk commodities. We need to talk about the move in gold, but also in silver, which seemingly still lagging behind. I haven't looked at the gold-silver ratio lately, I have to admit, but I hear it's been widening again because gold just outpaced silver a bit. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts. But also, you mentioned before we hit the record, but let's also talk about uranium, copper, but also, you know, silver I mentioned. So let's start with gold. We touched on 2220, which is a fantastic rally. I thought, once we break through 2200, we're off to the races, quite honestly. But it didn't hold. Bit of a correction today. We're at 2180, not that far off. So I'm curious, like, A, what triggered the move to that current price level, and why didn't it hold up there?
Well, as for what's triggering the move, there are two answers. One is that gold should be $5,000 an ounce anyhow. So if it goes up, it's just because it should have been much higher to begin with, and we don't need to think about it anymore. The other part is central bank buying. All of a sudden, the central banks are whales in the gold market over the last five or so years. They've gone from being fairly aggressive sellers of gold to very aggressive buyers. So the last 2 years, they've, these are just official numbers, they could be much higher, but officially, central banks have bought 1,000 tons of gold in each of the last 2 years. And that's maybe 1/4 of the world's mine output just being taken off the market by very strong hands who aren't going to be trading it. You know, if you're the People's Bank of China and gold goes up another couple $100 an ounce, you're not going to turn around and sell what you've bought. That's your monetary base now. You know, you're just going to put it away and hold on to it in anticipation of some kind of a big currency reset out there, in which gold almost certainly is revalued to a much higher level. So gold the supply demand calculus right now is much tighter than it used to be because you got these whales in the market taking so much off the market. And that's probably a big part of what's driving the price of gold higher generally. And the other more near term is the Fed stuff that we talked about, right? If they're going to start lowering interest rates in the face of sticky and too high inflation, then we're in kind of a stagflationary environment, which is phenomenal for gold. You know, there are some people looking back to the 1970s going, yes, that's what's happening again. And I missed being all in on, with silver in the late 1970s. I'm not going to miss that again with gold and silver. You know, I'm going to load up because that's what's happening again. So you have several different parts of the market all kind of reacting in a bullish way right now, and that's helping gold. And if it's the case that, you know, the central banks are still going to be buyers and people are going to replicate the 1970s in their investment portfolios, then yeah, gold should just take off from here. But a less spectacular, but still pretty favorable scenario is that, you know, 2000 used to be resistance for gold, and it bounced off of it and bounced off of it and bounced off of it and finally pierced it. And maybe 2000 or 2200 is the new resistance and 2000 is support. So we're maybe going to be back in a trading range, you know, $200 an ounce trading range, but a higher trading range, which is good for the miners because that means they've got sustained higher margins going forward, which means more cash flow and positive quarterly reports and things like that until people finally, you know, rediscover the miners and get excited again. So the modest scenario is still pretty good for precious metals and possibly very good for the miners in this case. So I'm optimistic, you know, intermediate term about both gold and silver and the miners.
Like we got quarter end coming up here in a few days as well. But one thing to just sort of counterbalance, and I don't want to get off the gold topic. I just want to throw in additionally, because margin compression was a big topic for the Newmonts, for the Barricks of the world, of course, because gold prices rallied, as you said, to 2000, but the margins were the same. Then they were at like 1300. They used to produce at $700 all in, while gold was at 1300, $600 margin. Now their gold was at 2000, they were producing at 1400. I think that number is actually pretty accurate to what Newmont has been reporting. So the margin has been the same, right? Or actually even shrinking a little bit. So the algorithms hated it. They dumped the stock. They didn't like it. And the generalists as well is like, I'm not making money here. Like, I think Barrick is still way below its, I don't know, like 2008 highs, or whatever it was, way below that. And the gold price is almost three times as high. Right. So oil, I wanted to throw that in. That's why I was mentioning it. Oil in terms of inflation and margin compression, because oil has been rallying as well. We're right around $83, $84 a barrel right now. It has been creeping up. Do you see that as a mood dampener at all?
Well, oil is a really interesting story with once again, a lot of cross currents, because there's the peak oil story that, we still have oil, but we're running out of cheap oil. And going forward, the price has to be higher in order to incent us to go out and get the oil we need. That's one part of the story. The other recently came from Doomberg, who's very big on Substack, and you know they're making a name for themselves as oil analysts or energy analysts. And their new take is that if you're looking at peak oil, you have to include natural gas in the equation because so many petroleum products can be made out of natural gas. So you should just basically add natural gas supplies into the oil supply and see what happens. And we're making, you know, we're producing massive amounts of natural gas in the US at very low prices today, because in part because it's a byproduct of producing oil. You know, it's just a thing that comes with the main thing that you're doing if you're an oil company. And we should calculate that as an oil analog. And then when you look at the supply of oil on those terms, the supply of oil is going way up. So we're not in a peak oil scenario. And we won't be in a peak oil scenario for another 50 years, if ever. So that changes the calculus of oil prices going forward, right? It's possible that oil maybe should be a little bit lower than it is right now. So that's the tricky thing about investing in oil. is that, you know, you've got two different pretty reasonable scenarios out there that result in very different price levels. So I have some oil stocks. I like the concept because they are generating free cash flow right now. They're paying dividends and raising their dividends. And they're a geopolitical kicker. You know, if we start bombing Iran or something like that, which half the government seems to really want to do, oil will spike like crazy. And so if you're an oil company with North American reserves, you become much more valuable. And that is, you know, that's not a tiny little probability scenario. That's actually, I wouldn't put it in the realm of probability right now, but it's completely feasible. And so you add that to good cash flow and stuff like that. And I think the oil companies remain interesting investments.
Just, sorry, like I must have, the question is like, will the oil price put a dampener on like the mining stocks? Like I'm actually quite euphoric to see quarter end as well. So like, do you see that as a factor? By the way, I love the discourse on oil. That's why I didn't stop you at all, because I think it's an important topic to talk about. But I'm curious, like when I start looking at the Q1 numbers that will be coming out at the end of March, at the end of April, should I get ecstatic or should I hold my horses based on, you know, higher costs for oil and gas? Because that's a big cost factor, especially for remote operations.
Well, miners are still seeing inflation in some of their inputs, including labor, too. You know, it's expensive to hire new engineers and new oil field workers and mine workers. And that's a real thing for the miners. But I think at, say, $2,100 to $2,200 an ounce gold, you do get some margin expansion for the most efficient operators, and we'll get some reasonably positive quarterly results, and I think that'll help. Now, $2,500 gold would help more, but I still think that the mining industry generates free cash flow at today's levels. In the case of the best, most efficient miners, you know, there are outliers in the negative direction who are just going to have trouble making money no matter what, you know.
I was going to say always. Running.
So you want to own quality companies in that space because they're the ones most capable of taking advantage of positive trends in the industry. And then maybe you want to look at the royalty companies because they basically just have contracted amounts of gold and silver coming their way without having to deal with energy costs or even labor costs. They have incredibly small staffs relative to their revenues. And that might be, in this kind of an environment where costs are going up, that might be a better place to be for precious metals mining investors, you know? And you know, so just don't worry about the mining issues that are out there. Just buy the guys who are contracted to get a little bit of most big mines output. And you are in a lower risk situation, but with still a lot of upside, because those are the guys who see margin expansion. You know, they're already contracted for prices and stuff like that, and they see the margins go up, at least to an extent, when the price of gold and silver go up.
No, I'm definitely hoping for a bit of a trigger for the generalists to come in. And if they see they can make money again, the mining stocks and the miners are actually making more revenue, maybe increasing dividends, which I'm not too hopeful about, or at least do something with the cash flow, right, nowadays, because they're barely sitting on any debt anymore anyway. So they've really taken good care of their balance sheets. So it's time for some outrageous acquisitions, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. You cannot trust CEOs in any industry to sit on cash and free cash flow for very long, right? They're going to go out and start building empires. And in the mining sector, they're also, in a lot of cases, not completely replacing their reserves each year. So unless they want to just zero out and cease to exist, they need more reserves. And so I think that the highest quality juniors and explorers are increasingly good takeover candidates going forward, just because the big miners, you know, they've got that cash, they've got the free cash flow, and they really need to replace their reserves. So a lot of little guys are going to get bought out. And I think the big risk for the best quality juniors and explorers is that they get bought out in this environment where a nice premium over today's price is nothing. You know, it's just it's really not why you get into those stocks. If you get a 50% premium because Newmont buys them out, you want a five bagger with those stocks. And so you need kind of a rip-roaring bull market in precious metals to get people excited enough, or you need some high profile acquisitions to get people excited about what's next. You know, who, what other junior is going to be bought out? But you don't want to own the juniors that get bought out first. That's the intellectual challenge, right? Is how do you buy the quality juniors, but not the quality juniors that Agnico Eagle wants to buy out right away? So I don't have a good answer for that.
No, that one is a tough one. Who's first, right? Who's first on the chopping block? So I just looked up the gold-silver ratio. So we're sitting at 85-70. It's been creeping up a little bit. Just the beginning of, what's the scale here? Sorry, apologies. I don't use that website too often. But it's been ticking up. Like, it's been an uptrend from 80 to 85. So seemingly the silver price is still underperforming gold. And I think... why is that? We need to discuss that briefly there, John. Like, here's what your thoughts are. Is it really just because it's also perceived as an industrial metal now?
Yeah, I think multiple reasons. One is that it's been so boring for so long that an awful lot of people have just stopped paying attention to it. So we can go to 27 or 28 without those, you know, those people who used to be in silver even knowing that that's happening. So it needs a pop to reattract momentum buyers and the old silver stackers and silver bugs. Part of the problem is that it's an industrial metal. So, but you know, if it was just an industrial metal, it would still have a great story right now, because the world's silver mines are not producing as much as the world's silver users are taking off the market right now. So it's in deficit. And deficits that go on for a little while turn into shortages where people have to pay up to get what they absolutely need. And at the same time, there are new technologies coming along that use silver. There's solar panels. The next generation of solar panels use a little more than the current generation of solar panels do in terms of silver. And there are fuel cells being developed that use silver to replace platinum. So you've got some very positive usage trends out there in the silver market, while supply trends are flat to down. You know, Mexico is not producing as much silver as it used to, and the Mexican president just floated the idea of banning open pit mines. You know, so that won't help the supply of silver. So if you just looked at it that way, if silver was named tin or nickel or something like that, and you just looked at the supply-demand dynamics from industrial users and mines, you'd say, okay, this is headed for a shortage and headed for higher prices because of that shortage. And then you add in that it's a monetary metal, and it tends to follow gold during precious metals bull markets, and we seem to be entering a precious metals bull market. You know, the silver story looks awesome. I am still a buyer of silver even after all these years, you know, because of that. I think that at some point, see, when gold gets to a certain point, you also have the aesthetics of the whole thing coming in. You know, you can buy one Krugerrand, right? And it's pretty, but it's very small. And then you think, how many ounces of silver, which piled on a table is really a gorgeous sight, how many can I get for the price of that one Krugerrand? And so people tend to start buying silver because it's much cheaper than gold, but it serves the same function. It's a monetary metal. And then the bull market really takes off and silver dramatically outperforms gold. You know, that's the way it's gone for the past few precious metals bull markets. No reason to think it won't happen again. It's just that we're in a very early stage of this process. You know, gold is up, but nobody's excited yet. And in part, that's because you got Bitcoin doing spectacular things and Nvidia doing spectacular things. So gold going to its all-time nominal high, but not its inflation-adjusted high, pales into insignificance next to the other bubble stories out there. But those bubble stories will eventually burst, and gold is probably going to go a lot higher because of all the monetary stupidity that's going on out there, and the demand tightness that's going to come from the central banks buying and from investors. You know, it's going to be a dramatic bull market in precious metals. in which gold leads to begin with, and then silver leads in the later stages. So there's a 2 or 3 year stretch out there where silver is the best thing in the world to own. And you know, we kind of have to be there ahead of time, right? Or else we miss the beginnings of the big move.
Absolutely. John, at the beginning of the conversation, I thought we'd had a lot of time to talk about the last two topics, copper and uranium. And now we're coming up to the top of the hour. We're like 55 minutes into the conversation, and I'm only bringing copper and uranium up now. But let's spend very little time on it, really. Like, let's talk copper. You talked about supply, demand, shortages on the silver side. I think it's even more crass on the copper side. I think even in Q2 this year, we're going to be starting to see a deficit.
Oh, yeah. If we're going to electrify the world, we need twice as much silver as we're getting out of mines right now. And it's not even clear that we're going to get the same amount out of silver mine or out of copper mines as we have gotten in the recent past. And part of that is because of mining becoming a much tougher business. You know, you saw obviously the Cobre Panama drama, where Panama just shut down one of the world's biggest copper mines. And copper itself went up nicely on that news. You know, copper has gone up quite a bit in the last few months. And that might not be the end of the story with mining being just very tough, because copper mines in particular are very big. You know, they're really intrusive and environmentally problematic in a lot of cases. So there are some big deposits out there, but it's going to be harder to bring them online than it might have been 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And it could be that because of that, ramping up to twice today's silver output is going to be hard, you know, and it might not happen. And if that's the case, and we still try to electrify the world, then the price has to go up because of a supply imbalance. And I think that's, you know, that's a highly possible story for copper. There are things that could derail it, but those things would be catastrophic in some cases. No. So I think it's probably going to happen. And then uranium, the story is even better than copper in a lot of ways, because basically the world got a little too enamored of the idea of alternative energy and you know, green energy. And they started shutting down perfectly functional nuclear plants, especially in Germany and also in Japan. They took a lot of the pipeline of new plants offline. So you know, got a lot of mothballed plants. You got a much smaller supply of nuclear power coming online as was expected. And then solar and wind turned out not to work nearly as well as everybody thought. So surprise. Surprise. I was a fan of solar, but not of wind going into this, because wind is just it's an engineering issue, which doesn't look like it should work. Solar, though, I thought would do much better than it has. It's turning out to have some problems too, but it still works in the right places. You know, if you're in a reasonably sunny place, solar is a good thing to slap up on your roof and just, you know, take yourself off grid. But we need more power, and it's not clear where we get it if we don't get it from nuclear. So a lot of countries are going back to nuclear. China has this massive pipeline of nuclear plants, and a lot of other countries are ramping up their nuclear fleets. And a lot of uranium is going to be needed to feed those nuclear plants. And it's not clear where that comes from. You know, we need twice as much uranium as we have now in order to fuel the world of a decade or decade and a half hence. And that means if you've got accessible, reasonably efficient uranium reserves, you're becoming a much more valuable entity than you were in the past. So the big uranium stocks have gone up dramatically here. And I don't see any reason for it not to be a bull market for at least another decade. And the big thing getting in the way of that would be another Fukushima. Like if we have another nuclear plant meltdown, then that derails the process for a while, but only for a while. You know, the nuclear is kind of inevitable, barring some new technology.
What are the alternatives? Like, what are other commercially viable alternatives? Right. I don't want to get into that debate, but as you said, like, it's not wind, it's not solar. Fission is too far away, so it's not viable.
Solar combined with natural gas is a partial competitor to nuclear. And you know, we should be doing that too, you know, but the, but you're right. There's no other really large scale thing out there. Thermonuclear fusion.
I thought the chip, like I saw on Twitter, like one of the chip factories or like every new chip factory needs like a gigawatt of power. Right. So where is that supposed to come from? And we're building chip factories like crazy.
That's right. Because, okay. So we've got Bitcoin mining, which is massively energy hungry.
We're doing that in Sweden because it's cheap.
Yeah. And we've got, or Iceland, right? Where you just do geothermal, but AI is a huge energy hog and it's just starting right now. So that is something that, kind of came out of nowhere in terms of people's projections of the amount of power that we're going to need going forward. And it's just taking off. You know, nobody is slowing down their creation of AIs and the building out of that infrastructure. So the power has to come from somewhere. And, you know, it's not even clear that nuclear can ramp up in time to keep up with this trend. So it could be that we've got some serious power shortages out there in front of us.
Just don't charge your cars anymore.
Well, see, that's the thing. Electric cars aren't working out the way they were supposed to either. And maybe slower uptake of electric cars will partially provide the power in the future that goes to AI. I don't quite see that balancing out the way that it might. But if we have this massive AI build out and that causes power shortages and much higher electricity costs, then that incents new nuclear plants. But you can only put those up at the pace that you can do it. But at that point, maybe the small modular reactors come online. That's a technology that hasn't been proven to work yet, but a lot of people think it's going to.
Well, it's a regulatory thing as well, right? So where are you going to put, and who are you going to have run, who are you going to have to run, or like, who are you going to allow to run small nuclear reactors, right? Who are you going to get the power to, right? So those are small nuclear bombs as well. So it's an interesting topic, I think. So
it is. It's very interesting. And I think the odds are that uranium benefits from the way this plays out in a very big way. So I think the best quality uranium stocks are long-term must owns. You know, there could be a correction in the uranium price just because it's gone up so much lately. It's corrected a little bit, but nothing goes in a straight line and it could correct more from here. And that could make the uranium miners a little cheaper. But I think generally intermediate and long-term uranium is a spectacular story.
Absolutely. Fantastic. John, we got to wrap it up here. It's been an hour and 2 minutes. I tremendously enjoyed this conversation, as you might have guessed here. And I hope it was perfect for our audience as well. John, where can we find more of you? Where can we follow? I think rubino.substack.com is the way to go.
Yeah, that's where I am, Kai. Rubino.substack.com. And it's a newsletter that focuses on actionable advice for the stuff that you and I talked about that's coming. So I'm, you know, making portfolios and talking about a lot of kinds of prepping and self-improvement things that will prepare us for what is going to be a really chaotic decade.
Oh, absolutely. It is chaotic. That's why we're trying to educate here on this channel. And John, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. And everybody else, I hope this was insightful. I tremendously enjoyed this conversation. That's why we're at an hour and 2 minutes right now. So really appreciate you tuning in. Thanks so much for watching. And maybe let us know in the comments, do you like these longer form conversations? Or should we just be strict and cut them off at 30 minutes and to try to squeeze as much in there as possible? Personally, I really enjoyed this. It's a great way to mix it in and maybe go on in depth on a few topics, ask a few more follow-up questions instead of just jumping from topic to topic that we want to touch on, because there's so much going on. It's really difficult just to make sense of it all with just a quick short conversation sometimes. So let us know how we're doing, how you like our guests, how you like the questions. We do want to hear from you. It helps us out tremendously. And if you haven't done so, please hit that subscribe button. We do want to get a bigger audience here as well, because I think we're doing... Actually, I know we're doing a good job here trying to educate investors based on the guests we're bringing on, because we got fantastic guests on this channel and we got a great audience. Thanks so much for the feedback received so far. We'll be back with lots more here on this channel. Have a good one. Thank you.